You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an expert about what teens are learning about sex from online pornography. First, the 2018 Winter Paralympics kick off tomorrow, and in our continuing coverage of Wisconsin Paralympians, WPR's Maureen McCollum recently spoke with curler Justin Marshall. He's a native of Evansville who's been in a wheelchair ever since suffering a spinal cord stroke at the age of 12.
You've only been curling for a few years, right?
4 years, yeah.
So why did you first start curling?
About 4 years ago, I was watching the Olympic trials on like ESPN 2, 3, whatever it was, like really late at night. And they looked to a guy on the crowd and they talked about how he was the father of two current Olympians. And he was also the Paralympic coach and he was out of Madison, Wisconsin. So that kind of got my mind thinking and I went to work the next day and there was a guy I worked with who had talked about how he was a curler and curled a few times. And so I went and talked to him. He's like, oh, yeah, I know Steve Brown. I'll introduce you to him. And met him. And basically from then on, he just encouraged me, we got to get on the ice. Let's go. You got to try this. So I did. And after being on the ice like three, maybe four times, he's like, you have to come to the Team USA tryouts. And I was like, no, that's like way too soon. I don't know the terms of the game even. I don't know what I'm doing. And he's like, you have to come. And that year I ended up making the top eight high performance teams. So that just kind of fueled it. And I just started practicing, training every day and just fully engulfed in it.
That's amazing. Like, people work their whole lives for this and apparently you're just a natural.
I wouldn't say that, but I got lucky. I'd say I got lucky.
So what do you think it is about you? What sort of skill set are you bringing to the team that made you part of Team USA?
Great question. I'm not sure. I like to say that I have a pretty even keel out on the ice. I'm able to keep everyone kind of calm, but I like to keep things lighthearted. At the end of the day, we're playing a game out there, and so we need to have some fun. Not make it so crazy, stressful, and business-oriented, but be able to relax and, you know, just play as good as we can out there.
What is it about curling that you love so much?
I've always been super competitive, so that's, you know, that helps. I love competition of any form, in any form, and so that helps. But I also, my profession, I'm an architectural associate, so I love spatial relations and geometry and how things line up and align, and, you know, that's so much a part of this sport is angles and, you know, just all that sort of stuff. So it all kind of just combined in this sport, and I got addicted.
As a curler, you're not making millions of dollars off your sport, so you have to hold down a full-time job. Has your job been accommodating to your curling schedule?
Yeah, they've been pretty good about it all. I mean, I travel a lot for this, and so basically, my daily routine is I get to work at 6 a.m., I work till 2 p.m., and I cut out of there to come over here and practice for 2 hours before league starts, and then I, you know, head home to my wife. So it's a busy schedule, you know, I'm not there when other people are there, so it makes communication at work hard. And then I travel a lot, like this year, because it's the Olympic year, you know, I've probably taken 2 to 3 months of unpaid leave, but they've been accommodating in that fact that they're willing to let me travel and do all this and chase this dream without letting me go.
Some of the other curlers here at the Madison Curling Club were saying that the big hope for the future would be that curling becomes professional in the United States. Is that something you hope for too?
That'd be nice. I'm not really holding my breath for that. Just I know how the funding, you know, works, and it's just not there for our sport yet. But it's gaining momentum, and you know, people stop me on the street just to ask me about the sport because they see me maybe wearing my jacket or something like that. And so the interest is there. So hopefully one day, that'd be nice.
Well, I see your shirt, your uniform, you have some sponsors.
Right. Yeah. We definitely have some local sponsors and stuff like that, actually from all throughout the U.S. So anytime we go anywhere, we try and make, you know, the best of it and talk to as many people as we can just to educate people about the sport because it's one of those things like Wisconsin and Minnesota is kind of the epicenter of curling. Like around here, people have at least heard of it, but we actually had a training camp in Phoenix, Arizona, and people are like, we never even heard of this. So we're just trying to educate everyone about the sport.
Even if Wisconsin and Minnesota are the epicenter of curling, there are still so many people who don't get it here.
Yeah.
So how do you explain the sport to people? I generally tell people it's kind of like shuffleboard on ice.
Right. Yeah, that's about as good as it gets. It's shuffleboard on ice with a chess-type strategy, and it's scored like bocce ball. That's how I try to explain it. I mean, that's... because actually one of the hardest things to figure out is the scoring, too. It's kind of a weird system, but if you know bocce ball, that's how it's scored, I guess.
So when you're on the ice competing, do you have a philosophy that you follow as a team member? You said you like to keep spirits up, but what about game strategy?
Yeah, everyone out there is a little bit different, and I think that that's the interesting part about this sport is team dynamics. Just like any team sport, you know, you want to get to know each other as good as you possibly can to know when to say something to someone, when not to say something to someone, you know, just to kind of how to boost their ego or just kind of keep them mellow-headed when the time's right. There's times to speak up when you think there's an important strategy move, but you don't want to always be second-guessing them or always putting a secondary thought in their mind.
They'll know when you're speaking up that it actually matters.
Right. If you're speaking up all the time, you know, just kind of always saying something, it's going to be much easier for them to ignore you. But if you speak up, you know, one, two times per game, they might, you know, take a look at what you're actually saying or telling them.
So naively, what I did not know about wheelchair curling is that there's no sweeping involved.
Right.
So that's like a whole other element of skill that you have to have when you're playing.
Yeah. So because there's no sweeping, as soon as we let the stone go, there's no way to adjust either where that stone's going or how far it's going. So all we have a basically a static delivery. You sit still and you push the stone, but you're only pushing that stone for basically as long as your arm is. So you have about a 3-foot delivery to, you know, to get that stone where you want it to go, 120 feet down the sheet of ice. So when you think about, you know, what little control you have in that 3 feet, it's 100% muscle memory, really. I mean, that's why we're out here 5 days a week, a couple hours a day, just throwing stones. And so many of our stones that we throw are just what we call draw shots, which are just placing it in the middle of that target, just so you can build that muscle memory so that when you go somewhere else, and maybe the ice is a little bit different speed or it has more curl, you know that you need to adjust and how much you need to adjust based on where you're, you know, what your arm is used to.
And oftentimes with curling, you're at the whims of the ice, but even more so with wheelchair curling because you can't control it with sweeping.
Yep. So that's, we rely a lot on taking times from hog line to hog line so that if we can tell the ice is maybe a half second faster, and that way we can relay that to the other team members saying, hey, the ice is just a little bit quicker and a little straighter, so you're going to have to back off on your delivery just a little bit. So instead of aiming like you would be aiming to the middle of the target, back your home ice, now maybe pretend like you're aiming to the top of the target because it's going to travel an extra 4 feet. So that's when we start practicing, you know, different weights, where we're aiming, moving that aiming point around on the sheet of ice so that, you know, we just have all these little, I guess, tricks in our back pocket.
I know you've only been curling for a few years, but it must feel so amazing to be heading to the Paralympic Games.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. I mean, we've traveled a lot of cool places and done a decent little amount of international travel, but with this year, I mean, yeah, it's going to be a crazy couple months here, but really looking forward to it.
Your teammate Kirk Black, he trains out of the Madison Curling Club with you, and then your teammate Penny Greeley, she curls up in Green Bay, and you have two other team members who are out east.
Yeah, Steve Empt and Megan Leno, and they're out of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and somewhere in Connecticut.
So is it hard being apart?
That's probably one of the hardest parts that we spread out. It takes flights and hotel rooms and a, you know, full weekend trip. You're looking at a couple $1,000s just to practice together on any given weekend. So that's one of the, you know, I don't want to say downfalls, but it's one of the harder things, you know, to deal with as a team. It's a little, another hurdle to jump over, but we make the best of it. We try to see each other in a year like this at least once a month, get together and train somewhere, whether it be out on the East Coast, here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, wherever we happen to be.
Do you have any predictions for how you'll do? Obviously, coming home with a gold is ideal.
Yep, that's definitely the goal, and that's the hope. I mean, I'm just looking forward to the experience overall. I've talked to, you know, some of the past Olympians, some past Paralympians, and all they can say is just soak everything in, you know, just enjoy the moment. And that's what I'm going to try and do. I think really I'm looking forward to the opening ceremony. I've watched them on TV, you know, right? Like national anthem or whatever's playing, and they announce, you know, Team USA, right? And everyone comes walking out and waving and everything. So I think once that happens, it's all really going to hit home and, you know, sink in. But right now it's just kind of day-to-day grind of working and training and getting after it.
I'm such a sap. I have a hard time not crying while watching the Olympics.
Well, for the past, I don't know how many Olympics, like even before I was even a part of even being Team USA, I threw like Olympic parties where we like get together during the opening ceremonies and, you know, have a big party and like, yeah, USA. And now it's just, you know, it means 10 times more. Like, I never even thought that this would be a possibility, and now it's a reality.
That was WPR's Maureen McCollum talking with Justin Marshall, a native of Evansville, who's competing at the upcoming Paralympic Games in curling. On average, boys are about 13 years old the first time they see pornography. Girls, around 14. But few studies exist about how it translates into behavior and whether it shapes the way teens talk about intimacy, masculinity, and power. Some violence and dating experts believe we need to change the way we talk to teens about porn and sex, starting by actually talking to teens about porn and sex. Our next guest is the co-creator of a high school course on porn literacy. Emily Rothman is an associate professor and co-director of the Violence Prevention Research Unit at the Boston University School of Public Health. Adults, use discretion if there are younger listeners present. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm really happy to be here.
Well, starting with the need for porn literacy, it sounds like, looking at the numbers, teens are looking at porn, many of them, whether we know it or not, right?
It's true. So if you have a child who's 10 to 17 years old in your life, for example, the chance that they've seen pornography in the past year is about 42%. And the chance that they've gone looking for it on purpose in the past year is about 15 to 20%. And that's based on research by colleagues of mine at the University of New Hampshire.
And explain for us, what is porn literacy?
So porn literacy is the idea, it basically takes off from media literacy, which is teaching youth or adults that they can analyze and evaluate what they see in the media and critically think about, you know, what's being produced and what kind of messages it's giving them sort of beneath the surface. And so the idea with porn literacy is you don't just have to take porn at face value. If you see it, if you choose to see it, you can also think about what you're seeing and think about sort of how it's constructed or put together and what that might be teaching you or teaching other people.
Yeah, the concern is, and kind of the unknown is, are kids learning about sex and what sex is from porn mainly or solely from porn? Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I've done a couple of different research studies, and there's also been a national study out of University of Indiana where they have found that a lot of kids, in fact, the majority of kids, say that porn is their number one sort of preferred way to learn about sex. And this is especially true because there are so many states, 26 states in the United States, don't mandate any kind of sex education through schools, and only 13 of those states in the U.S. require that the material taught in sex ed is medically and scientifically accurate. So if they're not getting it at school, don't really feel like talking to parents about something like that, and the internet's right there, it's kind of natural that that might be where they seek out information. So the problem is they, you know, they're sexually inexperienced, and they think that what they're seeing on the screen is reality or realistic. And we all, you know, people know that pornography is, you know, it's staged and it's created, and a lot goes into making it look a certain way, and teenagers don't always know that.
Right. So what kind of ideas could teens be getting, boys and girls, about sex if their only source of knowledge and information is the porn they get to online?
Well, you know, we've heard both in our classes and also from some of the research that I've done that from girls in particular, I think that they don't realize that they have a right to pleasure because so much of pornography is from that male perspective or designed for a male view. So if that's what people are seeing, they sort of forget that, you know, females, girls are there too, and it can also, it should be about their pleasure. So sometimes they're not quite getting that. And the other thing is they get kind of unrealistic expectations. So I've had kids say to me, why are they making the, you know, why is the woman making those kind of noises? Why is she doing that? Or they'll see something biological happen that they didn't know happens or could happen and actually doesn't usually happen, and they'll think that that's normal and come to expect it.
Talking to Emily Rothman from Boston University's School of Public Health, talking about the idea of porn literacy. Kids, teens, often learning about sex in large part through the pornography they see online. She's talking about ways to talk to them about that, teach them about that. And Emily, the idea, I think, for a lot of parents, and I'm guessing educators, of talking to teenagers about pornography, that doesn't sound easy or productive. How do you start that conversation?
Yeah, well, I think an important thing to know is that we don't do this in school at all. So I think that it would be a tricky thing to probably get agreement from, you know, parents or an entire school community that this is something that we want to do. So we didn't even try to do that. We made this a voluntary class that kids who are in a very specific after-school program could sign up for if they wanted, and they got parental permission. They did not have to have ever seen pornography for the class to be relevant. The class certainly does not show pornography. But what it does is it kind of talks about, okay, we all know the kinds of things that people see in pornography. And, of course, you know, 100% of the kids have at some point, at least in the classes that we've had, seen pornography, and they did have some image, you know, some things that they could talk about. So it isn't actually awkward, because the two people who teach the class, Nicole Daly and Jess Alder, have worked for so many years doing dating violence and sexual violence prevention work. They have a really easy relationship with the kids, and they're able to talk about that kind of stuff straightforwardly with a lot of success.
Are teens wanting to talk about this and figure and sort out, truth from fiction in their porn consumption?
Yeah, you know, they really do seem to appreciate the opportunity to ask questions, to talk about it, to joke around, because it's an after-school setting, and, you know, it is a little bit more casual, and it's okay that they are sometimes laughing and smiling and teasing each other. That's fine. And they seem to actually really listen and really tune in. There were a lot of aha moments, I think, for kids. And we actually did some quantitative research, like a pretest and a post-test, where we asked them questions and were able to see if their attitudes or their knowledge really did change from pretest to post-test. And we know that they did on a number of things.
Let's talk about what parents can do. I think a lot of parents either have had or fear having the moment where they realize their kid is or has been looking at pornography. How can parents broach these issues with their kids?
Well, you know, there's two different answers to this. So the first I'll talk about is teenagers. I think with teenagers, it's very hard for anybody to want to talk about their sexual desire, I guess most people, their own sexual desires, sexual fantasies, sexual orientation sometimes with their parents, especially when they're an adolescent. But parents can do a lot by keeping the conversation pretty broad and just consistently reinforcing messages about the right way to treat people, respecting boundaries, that consent for things is important, and coaching them towards healthy relationships in general. If the topic of porn does come up directly, parents can say that there are, places where they can go. Scarleteen is, for example, a really good website to go to, where they can get factual information about sex and even about pornography there. So there's some great resources. The other one is when really little kids see pornography, and I have had some people ask me about that. I think one thing that you can do, because parental controls are not a fail-safe, is talk even to little kids about the fact that, you know, sometimes grown-ups like to see images of naked grown-ups. That might pop up sometime on your screen. If it happens, I want you to flip that, whatever it is, iPad, iPhone, over and call for an adult. And you can sort of rehearse it with them so that should it happen, because sometimes it can inadvertently, but they know what to do and don't just get sort of sucked into watching it because they can't look away.
And then what are your thoughts on more accessible sex education for kids so that, for many kids, porn isn't the only game in town when it comes to finding out about sex?
Well, that's what we really should be talking about. I think that's the main issue here. So for us, you know, the whole reason that we started this class is, as I said, we're interested in dating violence prevention, sexual violence prevention, and we just noticed that this was a great vehicle for having a conversation with kids where they were going to be really engaged and asking, you know, a lot of questions and really thinking about it, because it was so fun and new for them to talk about pornography. But the bottom line is, we really wanted to talk about safety, respect, consent. So if the real crisis, I think, is that there isn't comprehensive sex education in every school and that they have to get this information from other places. So by putting it off limits, it sort of does make it that much more of a charged topic, I think.
Briefly, as you wrap up, Emily, there's a lot of talk about consent in American culture right now with the Me Too movement. Do you see this as maybe an opportunity to start having these important conversations earlier for teens?
Absolutely. There's pornography that doesn't feature consent. There are some pornographers who on purpose make pornography that does show consent, and that's great. The majority of it doesn't, though. And so you can talk to the teens about, like, what aren't they seeing and why might it be important that everybody get consent every step of the way before you try anything new during a sexual encounter. And so, it's a great way to sort of talk about consent and do that.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
That's Emily Rothman. She's an associate professor and co-director of the Violence Prevention Research Unit at the Boston University School of Public Health. She joined us to talk about what teens are learning about sex from pornography and why porn literacy education could help. Now, in the aftermath of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, there have been a lot of conversations about school safety, gun control, and violence. We're exposed to violence in the news daily with reports of mass shootings, ongoing international conflicts, and more. As adults, it can be difficult to process. For children and teens, it can be even harder to grasp what's happening, and seeing images of violence can have a big impact on young people. Our next guest is here to talk about how parents and adults can have conversations with kids about violence in the news. Karen Riddle is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
First, big picture, how do children react? How does seeing violent images impact children of various ages?
The most prevalent and common reaction to violent images in the news is fear and anxiety. But there are developmental differences in what is exactly that scares kids. Younger kids, say 6 and younger, tend to be frightened by things that are visual, things that they can see. Older kids tend to be, so 6 and above, tend to be more frightened by not necessarily things that they have to see visually, but things that might happen in the real world, things that might actually happen to them, things that they are actually susceptible to, you know, experiencing. So for a younger child, they might be more likely to be frightened by these news shootings if it's accompanied by a very graphic or visual image. If it's not, it's possible that it could go over their heads. It might not have as strong as an impact. For the older kids, it doesn't have to necessarily be a visual image. Even just learning or hearing about it could get the older child starting to think about, okay, could this happen to me? Might I experience this?
Right. And with a school shooting in particular, There's got to be that connection. These are kids who went to school in the morning just like I did.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with older kids, they're very aware of that they know what the news is. Once you get to be about 7-8 years old, you know what the news is. These are things that are happening in the real world. For younger kids around 3, 4, 5, the news isn't necessarily any different from an episode of Scooby-Doo. It's just something out there that might be visually scaring. But older kids, they know what it is. So they know that this has happened in the real world, and they are thinking about, okay, could this happen to me? And the fact that some of these events are happening in schools then make it extra scary for the older kids.
Does social media add to the immediacy of violence, even if it's around the world? I mean, things from Paris or wherever around the world get retweeted or resnapped, they're sent around quickly right to kids' phones.
Certainly, and I think that that would be a factor more for the older kids than the younger kids. And some of them have protections or rules at school that prevent them from having devices. But those who are online and are on social media might hear this information faster. And I think that, the research on that is very new. In fact, I'm not even aware of any research yet that's really looking at the speed at which the news is traveling due to social media and how that reaches kids. But I think intuitively we might think that, of course, that's going to play a role.
I want to throw in one more possible cause of anxiety before we start to talk about how to talk about it.
Sure.
Kids are doing mass shooter drills or code red drills or whatever they're called in a particular district.
Yep.
Good to be prepared. Got to add some anxiety, though.
For sure. So my own kids are ages 6 and 12, and they go to Madison Public Schools and have both participated in these school drills. I think that the way that, you know, teachers and schools approach this is really important. And, of course, they have the utmost attention and sensitivity to the fact that the very drills themselves could frighten many children. On the other hand, kids like to have a sense of control, and they like knowing that somebody's in control, and they like knowing that there's a plan. And older kids in particularly, that's really important. So I think for older kids in particular, these drills could, for some kids, serve as something that's calming to let them know, okay, the school is prepared, you know, as well as they can be, that there are plans in place, that there is some sense of control over this might be reassuring to some kids. On the other hand, it might be really scary to others.
Talking to Karen Riddle, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, talking about how to talk to kids about violence in the news and violent images in the media. Let's get to that now, Karen, and Let's break it down age by age. Let's start with that 6 and under group. Kids have seen a disturbing image. Maybe it's in the news. Maybe it's in another form of entertainment. How do you talk that through with a kid that age?
So for young kids, the overarching advice is to use what scholars call non-cognitive strategies. And that's just a fancy way of saying, don't try to explain or rationalize or reason with them. There have been some studies where very well-meaning adults tried to rationalize and explain to a young kid under 6 something that was scary on TV and explain, oh, you shouldn't be afraid of this for XYZ reasons, with the goal of calming the kid down. And what happened in those studies was that it boomeranged. It made them worse off than if you'd said nothing at all. So it might be that your intent in explaining something to a young child may not be the outcome that you get. So what scholars recommend for young kids, if they become frightened by whether it's fictional entertainment or the news, non-cognitive strategies. So these would be things like snuggling with them, cuddling them, having a snack, grabbing a stuffed animal, distraction, right? With a young kid, a 3 or 4-year-old, you might be able to remove the offensive image, replace it with, you know, an episode of Clifford the Big Red Dog, and successfully distract them and have them forget about it. So those are the types of strategies we recommend with young kids. With older kids, once you get to age 7 or 8, you know, it's for most kids, a stuffed animal is not going to do the trick. Snuggling is not going to do the trick. And distracting is probably not going to do the trick. So for older kids, you really do want to use these more cognitive strategies. In other words, talking to them and explaining to them. Now, the question is, what do you say, right? I mean, as adults, we're all, frankly, I think, terrified of this. And what do you say to calm a child, an older child, down? One possibility is to talk about probability. You know, the probability of these events happening in your child's school really is fairly low. That said, adults, there are many things that adults know have a low probability of occurring, and we're still frightened of them. So you can try to focus on probability, but I think a potentially more successful route is that preparedness. Like I said, kids, older kids, they want to know that somebody's in control, and really explaining to them, here's what you would do, and here's what your school's going to do, and here's how your teachers are prepared, and here's how your principal is prepared, and here's how we are all prepared to deal with this. That preparedness can help them feel a little more confident, but we can't ever really feel 100% confident about these things.
So school shootings aren't the only kind of violence kids are going to see. International coverage, we see Syria and kids affected by war in that country. Refugee children dying as they try to cross the Mediterranean. Do different kind of stories have different impacts on kids and different ways to talk about them?
They do. So one study that I did found that proximity matters. So things that happen closer to home tend to be more frightening. So it's possible that a war going on in Syria or somewhere far away way may not be as scary. However, children's perceptions of what is proximate is not necessarily always accurate. So a young child might not realize that something is far away and that it doesn't affect them. So stories that are closer by, so a kidnapping story of a kidnapping in Madison would be very salient to children. If it was a kidnapping farther away, that might be less scary. For younger kids, because they are so impacted by visual images, they tend to be more frightened by news stories that are visual. So things like tornadoes, hurricanes, car crashes, things that are very visual and don't require a lot of processing tend to frighten the younger kids. Older kids, 7 and above, it tends to be more abstract things. The idea of a kidnapping, the idea of a school shooting, the idea of a war. So there's definitely developmental differences there.
Now, if we're not sitting there watching TV with the kid, we may not know that they've consumed some of these news images. Are there signs of anxiety that we can watch for and try to do detective work to figure out where it's coming from?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's even a greater concern among boys that they are maybe socialized to hide their feelings and to not express when they're frightened. But amongst both boys and girls, a lot of these symptoms might manifest at night, and they often manifest in the form of sleep disorders. So what we're seeing is, you know, kids waking up in the middle of the night with nightmares, coming into bed with mom and dad, just in general not being able to sleep. So if your child hasn't articulated anything, you know, during the daytime about something bothering them, but you're seeing these issues at night, it could be that there's something scaring them, and maybe it was something they saw in the media.
As we're hearing more about trauma-informed care for kids and adults, for that matter, we're learning that kids who are exposed to a variety of traumas, maybe including dealing with violence themselves, can have long-term impacts from that. Does media consumption of violence, does it rise to that level?
It can. There, after some really extreme events, 9/11 being one of them, some studies found symptoms in children that were verging on being PTSD levels of post-traumatic stress disorder, levels of anxiety afterwards. In terms of long-term effects, there are studies showing that years later, sometimes decades later, people can still very vividly remember things that scared them in the media as a child. And many adults will say, you know, to this day, I still have changed my behavior in some way. Sometimes this is due to fictional media. You know, I saw the movie Jaws as a child, and I'm still a little nervous in pools. I mean, truly, people say in pools and in the ocean. But sometimes it's due to the news. You know, I did a study once where adults recalled seeing a story about a plane crash as a child, and as adult still feel nervous when they get on a plane. So some of these are just kind of everyday, you know, phobias and fears, but they can rise to the level of being more severe.
We're talking to Karen Riddle. She's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison. She's with us to talk about how violent images can impact children and teens, and how parents can talk to kids about the violence they see in the media and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, do you find it difficult to talk about this subject with your kids? If you're a teenager, what do you wish you could talk about with your parents or someone else about when it comes to seeing violence in the news? If you're an educator, how do you approach this issue? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about the impact that seeing violence has on children in the wake of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Our guest has advice for parents and how they can talk to children and teens about violence in the news, violent images in the media. Karen Riddle is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, and questions. If you're a parent yourself, how do you talk to your kids about news and violence? How did you talk to your kids about the latest big mass shooting? What questions do you have about broaching the topic with your kids? If you work in the schools, how do you approach this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now, Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. This kind of comes down to being able to trust somebody, say, well, this person is a little different. So when we hear, well, if you see something, say something. Well, this person is a little different. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to strike out. But then if I don't say something and they do, that's what came up in Parkland. I said, well, Jesus, if I would have said something, then maybe this wouldn't have happened. So that's something children, anybody needs to be aware of and deal with.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. How do we approach these issues? And this is something that kids maybe see in the news. How do you look at someone and assess whether they might do something like this? How do we trust people?
Right. And I think that there's the risk that this spills into issues related to stereotyping and racism and are certain types of people that are more likely to get called out in ways that I think that could be concerning. But to the caller's point, you don't want to err on too much on the side of I'm going to say nothing and something disastrous can happen. So I think that's a very thin line to walk. And how do we advise kids to not go overboard on their reporting as well?
That reminds me of a related issue on children's safety and concepts of stranger danger. When something bad happens to a kid anywhere in the country, sometimes around the world, we're going to see it in the news. Statistically, kids are generally safer than they were 30, 40 years ago. Parents are more nervous, though, because of all the news we see. How do we mediate that part of the media we see?
I think that's exactly right. I think that there is this concern amongst parents today about all these horrible things that could happen to their children that maybe really do have a low probability of occurring. But it is possible that the media showing these types of images over the course of many years has kind of cultivated this sense of, oh, this dangerous world that we have to protect our kids from. And are we protecting them too much? Are we keeping them inside and sheltering them more than we need to? Is one possibility.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Vicky in Oregon. Vicky, hi.
Hi. When my son was quite young, there was actually a drive-by shooting near our house. And my son actually did really well initially with the fact that there had been police officers outside our front door and everything. As he got older, though, he became more aware that the bad guys had been very close to his house and became more anxious. And we ended up having to tell him how his dad had been in the Marines and basically trained to fight people so that he would feel safe.
Vicky, I'm sorry you had to go through that with your son. So this is something that initially didn't seem to affect him that much and snuck up later. And I imagine something similar could happen with kids seeing these media images too.
Absolutely. And that coping strategy that you use was a really smart one. It's exactly what I was saying, that this sense of control, somebody's in control, that there is a plan, that knowing that his father was trained, I would imagine helped quite a bit in calming down. It's a great, great idea for you to enact that strategy.
Vicky, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to branch out a little into non-news violence. We know in movies, video games, TV shows, there's a good bit of violence out there. Can you talk about age-appropriate ways to control what kids see and then how to talk about it?
Sure. So when talking about entertainment violence, the research on this has looked at a variety of outcomes. So we've been talking about fear and anxiety in the context of news, but there's other, and those outcomes are possible in reaction to TV shows and movies with violence, but there's other outcomes too. Scholars are looking at whether violence in the media can increase the likelihood of aggression in the audience, looking at whether or not media violence can desensitize people. And the research is suggesting that those outcomes are possible, especially amongst some people. And so the advice, the solution to this is complex, right? I mean, one of the biggest pieces of advice is for parents to be aware of the media that their children are using and be very involved in the selection of that. Ideally, in an ideal world, parents would be co-viewing with children all the time, and then they could talk and have conversations. So a violent action occurs and the parent is sitting right there and can say, hey, in the real world, we don't act like this. In the real world, here's a different way that person could have solved that problem. In reality, we don't always co-view with our children. As a parent myself, the TV is often a way that I can get dinner made or do laundry. So we're not always right there. So I think that trying to make time for those conversations at a later date, if you know that your child is watching shows that has violence in it, and it might be maybe those shows are showing violence in a way that kind of glamorizes it or sanitizes it, you might have an occasional conversation about, okay, let's talk about real world violence. Let's talk about what happens in the real world if somebody actually punches somebody else or shoots them. And having those conversations to kind of counter the messages that they hear in the media are important.
Is there a hard and fast cutoff age saying if your kid is under this age, just steer clear of violent images in the media as much as you can?
That's a great question. I mean, I think there isn't necessarily an age. A lot of the rating systems uses the age of 7 as kind of a cutoff age, and there's a lot of TV shows that are deemed to be okay for kids that are 7 or older. Parents, of course, can make their own decisions, though, about what's acceptable for their own child based on their own child's temperament, and may not agree necessarily with the rating system. So there isn't really a hard, fast age at which you would say, okay, now it's okay to start consuming violence. I would say parents of kids of all ages should really just be aware of the messages their kids are receiving about violence and aggression in the media, no matter what age they are, and just be aware of those messages. And if it's not a message that you agree with, that you provide your own, you know, a role model in yourself and conversations about, you know, that counter those messages, perhaps.
Is there research not just about the, I guess, quantity of violence that kids see in entertainment media versus the style of it, a cartoon,
yep,
versus a very realistic, bloody, gruesome depiction, yeah, of violence?
Yeah, and what we're seeing is that what the factors that parents are using to decide what their kids should and shouldn't watch aren't necessarily the ones that scholars would recommend. Parents often seem to be a little more calmed by violence that's animated or funny, whereas scholars feel like those could still be areas of concern. What we want parents to look at are the messages and the themes. So whether it's animated or not, whether it's bloody and gory or not, what is the message that's coming across? And it could be that an animated, funny, silly movie with no blood and gore might still be sending an inappropriate message about violence. It might be glamorizing violence or making it seem like no big deal or making it seem funny. So we would encourage parents to go beyond how much blood and gore is in a movie, how much realism it is, and really look at the themes and the patterns of the messages that are being sent to kids.
It sounds like one common theme, whether we're talking about violence in news media or in entertainment, is having that line of communication,
yeah,
between the parents and the kids. Again, breaking it down probably by age, how do we open that up? How do we start talking about it, especially maybe for teenagers who don't want to talk to their parents necessarily about anything?
Absolutely. There are a lot of online resources that provide printouts that parents can print out and can sign contracts with their children, and it would vary based on the age of the child. So it might be worth parents. Common Sense Media is one that has one of these. CommonSenseMedia.org has one of these contracts, and it's a nice starting point where you can negotiate based on your family and your values what you think is right for your child based on what you knew about your child. And I think that they make those age appropriate so you can tailor it to whatever the age of your child is, right? So if you have a 3-year-old, you don't necessarily need to negotiate cell phone use, but with a 15-year-old, you would, right? So you would tailor it based on, you know, what's going on in your own family based on the age of your child.
We'll leave it there for now, Karen. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Karen Riddle. She's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us today to talk about how parents can talk to their children and teenagers about violence they see in the news and in the entertainment media and the impact that seeing these images may have on kids. You can let us know still how you deal with this in your family or your school, for that matter. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the nation's national debt is pretty big, and recent laws by Congress are likely to make it bigger still. We'll talk to an expert about the annual deficit and the impact it could have on the economy and ultimately us. We'll preview the South by Southwest Music Festival and learn about some of the Wisconsin bands performing at the big event in Austin with Justin Barney from Radio Milwaukee. He's on his way down there right now, but he gave us a preview of a bunch of the bands heading down there this week. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, it's one thing to cook when you have all the time in the world. It's something else when you need to get something on the table. Now, we'll talk about cooking on a deadline. That and look at some of the top news going on tomorrow here on Central Time.